Hello and welcome to Kampnagel's podcast Stay in Touch. My name is Alina Buchberger and in today's podcast I'm talking to Hong Kong-based artist Royce NG. He is a visual artist and performer whose last work, Queen Zomia, was presented at Kampnagel in October 2018. Royce has been researching the history of opium trade in Southeast Asia for years now, looking at autonomous mountain people, the creation and functioning of the nation state, and the influence of colonial power structures in this area. Royce, I'm really super happy to welcome you to our podcast. How are you doing?
I'm doing really well, thank you. Thank you so much for having me on the podcast.
Maybe you can tell us a little bit about what's the situation in Hong Kong like right now.
So we've been under lockdown since the beginning of February, and it hasn't been as strict as in Europe or America. Restaurants have stayed open, but just with a social distancing rule between tables and limit of people per table. A lot of people are working from home, mm-hmm. but you're still allowed to go out onto the streets as long as you wear a face mask. And we're quite lucky in Hong Kong. We've only had 4 deaths, 1, 2, 3, 4, and we have about 1,000 cases in all this time, mm-hmm. which is quite incredible considering we share a border with mainland China and it's a very small, densely populated place. So, yeah, we're quite lucky in that sense. And we're kind of... the announcement was made today to reopen the majority of businesses because we've had this consistent pattern of 0 cases for the past 2 weeks. Mm-hmm. So we're easing out of the lockdown, so which might be similar to what's happening in Hamburg and
yes.
Germany at the moment.
So, yes, exactly. Yeah. Mm. Actually, you just mentioned people wearing masks in the street, and I remember last time we spoke, you told me something like, in Hong Kong, the only people still refusing to wear a face mask are white dudes, which, kind of reminded me of Donald Trump's performance of masculinity and white supremacy during the crisis. It also made me think of an article I recently read stating that women in Germany who have been covering their faces for a long time are now experiencing less angry looks, less racist comments in the street, and so on. I mean, also if you think about protest culture, covering your face, and conflicts with the police about that, is there somehow, a male or Western obsession with this covered versus the naked face issue?
Yeah, it's an interesting issue. I don't entirely understand it. I think there's, from the perspective of Western governments, I think that part of it is the recommendation for the public not to wear masks is basically a supply issue that mm-hmm. Because of the lack of supply, they want to reserve them for health workers. And so they make this kind of recommendation for the general public not to wear them. So in a way, it's kind of covering up their own failures. Mm-hmm. I think that's that. One thing I hear quite often from family and friends in Australia and in Europe, people say the phrase, well, it's not in our culture to wear the face mask, which is a curious statement to me. It's the presumption being that it is in our culture, meaning like East mm-hmm. Asian culture. It's been nobody's culture to wear a surgical mask
yes.
in that sense. But Hong Kong and some parts of Asia do have the experience from 17 years ago with the SARS crisis. So this other COVID virus, which broke out in China in 2003, and there was a kind of internalization of health kind of measures to protect the community. And one of those was mask wearing. So I think it's in Hong Kong, a part of the reason why we've had such a low infection rate is that everyone essentially is, when the virus broke out in Wuhan, that we all took it upon ourselves to look after ourselves and our families and our community by wearing masks, having been through this previous experience 17 years ago. There's another issue going on, which is that on October 4th, 2019, October last year, there was actually an anti-mask ban put forth by the Hong Kong government. So this was during the height of the Hong Kong anti-extradition bill protests.
Yes.
And that's still moving through the courts at the moment. And that was essentially a way for people, for the government to stop protesters from hiding their faces and to avoid detection for arrest, and also to avoid facial recognition with by like surveillance systems. And so this is still moving through the court, this anti-mask ban, at the same time that the Hong Kong government is also handing out one free mask to every single citizen.
Wow, okay.
So there are all these kind of contradictory things happening this time. And I guess to what you were saying, it never quite... it was always an interesting issue for me, this this burqa ban that happened in France
yes.
in 2011. And that was clearly in defense of the secular kind of notion of the French state. And for me, it always seemed as this kind of secular intolerance, which is, well, maybe it's not a contradiction. Maybe they do go hand in hand, but... It seemed to me like defending freedom by depriving people of their freedom
mm-hmm.
was a kind of circular logic, contradiction in there. So, yeah, it's a difficult question to answer to understand this.
I think the question of showing your face in the public space also as a way for authorities to be able to identify you via face recognition is especially interesting considering the protests that you just mentioned. I would be interested to hear a little bit more about these protests, how you experienced them, maybe even during the last months, and how the situation mm-hmm. changed also with the pandemic and the new rules that have been put up for public space.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So the protest movement in Hong Kong it began in June of 2019 and was basically in response to the introduction of an extradition bill put forth by the Hong Kong Legislative Council. So there was this extradition bill put forth in, I think, February last year, which would essentially allow, was essentially an extradition treaty to be put forth between Hong Kong, Macau, Taiwan and China, where there previously were no extradition treaties. But the fear was that this would allow the mainland Chinese government to impinge on the legal sovereignty of Hong Kong and extradite people from Hong Kong for possible illegal activities in Hong Kong or in the mainland, or basically based on the mainland Chinese's discretion. And the fear of this comes from the kidnapping of several booksellers in Hong Kong over the last few years for publishing controversial books or books critical of the mainland Chinese government.
Mm-hmm.
And so there was an attempt by the Hong Kong Legislative Council to push through this bill, and there was this kind of a slow build-up of protests. And then in June there was a large public march. Over a million people attended. And the Hong Kong government deployed tear gas in that march. And this was kind of, I guess this was the watershed moment in the movement. It was kind of a completely unprovoked deployment of tear gas.
Yeah.
And then things kind of spiraled out of control from that point on, and various complex things happened in Hong Kong. One was there was an attack on protesters by thugs, or what the like organized crime syndicates known as triads in Hong Kong.
Mm-hmm.
And they were seemingly being protected by the Hong Kong police. And then the brutality of the Hong Kong police force against protesters got worse and worse. And the Hong Kong government eventually, actually relatively early, did withdraw this extradition treaty. But the kind of enmities which arose between the protesters and the police got more and more extreme, and to the point where it almost felt like a civil war between the protesters and the police themselves.
Yeah.
And so it's had a massive effect on Hong Kong. Like one part of that was that Hong Kong is incredibly dependent on mainland China, especially mainland Chinese tourism and their kind of consumer dollars, as most of the world is, I guess, at this point. And the Chinese government recommended that Chinese no longer, as the government recommendation, a travel warning against Chinese visitors to Hong Kong. And so that kind of staved off the supply of tourists to Hong Kong, which was a major part of our economy. So we've had this kind of political collapse and then kind of economic collapse.
So yeah. Actually travels between mainland China and Hong Kong were already quite reduced way earlier than...
Yes.
Yeah, then, yes. Then the pandemic really kicked off.
And so actually that was to our benefit. So there were no Chinese tourists coming to Hong Kong already. And so that, yeah, actually one of the unexpected benefits of that. And other events, major events in the movement, there was the occupation of the airport. And then I guess things really came to a head in November. I do teaching at the university, at the Chinese University of Hong Kong, and essentially the two universities and were occupied by students, the Chinese University of Hong Kong and the Polytechnic University of Hong Kong, and they became the sites of a siege between the police and student protesters who were trapped on the campus. And the police weren't letting them out of the campus. And there was essentially an attempt by the police to round up all the protesters and to enforce mass arrests to try and strangle the movement. And the university I teach at, that went on for about a week. It was a war zone, but it was also a kind of one of these... this idea of a temporary or autonomous zone,
mm-hmm.
Where students, kids really, had built like a supply line of Molotov cocktails, were booby-trapping the entire campus. They had made makeshift improvised slingshots and were flinging flaming arrows against the police. This is really like, it's got kind of medieval. But somehow the focus of the police attention moved from the Chinese university campus to this Polytechnic University campus. There were several thousand students trapped on the campus for weeks on end. And it was a really, really horrendous situation. And something I'll never forget was... in November, there was a night when there was a call out to basically for everybody in the city to come out to try to start protests all across the city in order to divert the attention of the police who was had this barricade siege against the protesters and try to draw them away to allow the students to escape. And so we all went out onto the streets, and everyone was pulling up the bricks from the streets, from the road, so the cars can drive past. They were making bamboo barricades and defences on every street corner. And there was Molotov cocktail supply lines that were running for hundreds of metres from one end of the city to the other. And I come from Australia, you know, a relatively safe country from this middle-class background, and you never quite realise how easy it is for a place, the veneer of civilization, to slip, and for like a place to become a war zone. Essentially, it's something I'll never forget. But also, the solidarity on the ground was incredible. Like just going out and everyone, the self-organization of the protesters, and you'd go out onto the street and just join these kind of production lines for weapons and supplies. And yeah, it was quite incredible. And so basically the culmination of this 6 months of protests was there was a district council election where most of the pro-establishment candidates, so these pro-Beijing candidates, were all wiped out, and all these novice first-time candidates, like university students, would just put up their names because there was so much negative feeling against the establishment government from the general population that all these seasoned politicians lost their seats, and it gave a platform to a whole new generation of young activists and politicians. And that was a small vindication for the previous 6 months. And then the movement lulled, has been in a kind of lull. There have been sporadic outbursts. But we kind of transitioned nicely from that 6 months of chaos straight into the coronavirus. And as you mentioned, because there had always already been these travel bans against Chinese, we didn't have the influx of the virus coming into Hong Kong that we might otherwise have had. And the other element of that was that the distrust of the government in Hong Kong was so great because of that previous 6 months that the community, all Hong Kongers, kind of decided that we need to protect ourselves. And so everybody kind of spontaneously just stayed at home, spontaneously put on masks, spontaneously practiced social distancing, having gone through the experience already 17 years ago, knowing what the protocol is for doing with dealing with epidemic.
Yes.
And I think that's another part of, why we've been fortunate with the infection rates here.
So you've been going from one emergency state to a completely different one in, in a period of 6 months, which is really enormous to imagine. I think I would be interested, I mean, we already talked a little bit about public space, masks, and maybe you can explore a little bit, because I know that you are working on a new project, and this project is, comes with a deep research on technological innovation, on acceleration, on surveillance techniques. I would be interested to hear a little bit about your project and maybe also develop on the current situation, how is linked to this project.
So the current performance I'm developing is based on an exhibition that I had in Cologne at the Akademie der Kunst der Welt in October last year. And the title of the exhibition was Sino-Fi, and was curated by Mi Yu, a German-based Chinese curator, and it was a collaboration with a Shenzhen-based architecture firm, Swooding Architects, and the collective I work with, Zheng Mala. And essentially, the exhibition was looking at the technological accelerationism of China and the social and political implications of this as a kind of speculative project. So China itself, modern China, to just put it in context, the Chinese Communist Party, it sees itself as coming out of this century of humiliation. So basically occupation by Western powers. Mm-hmm. And but one of the core points of this was that China sees itself as having missed out on the first wave of the Industrial Revolution. And that's why it became strategically weak in relation to other world global powers in the 19th century. And so basically they don't want to repeat that mistake again. And the way to approach that is to invest in cutting edge technology as a development model for the country, for the nation, rather than going through this kind of movement from low-end technologies through to high-end technologies. The idea was to simply leapfrog and ahead and go straight to the high-tech. And so one of the consequences is that China is one of the first countries in the world to release a government white paper on artificial intelligence, and that was in 2017. Uh-huh. And they're incredibly invested in developing all these new technologies. The question we're interested in is what's happening when China, with its great firewall and with these increasing technological innovation divides between the West and China, as they increase, as they accelerate, what will be the kind of consequences of this? And yeah, essentially the work is exploring this from various different angles. And we can see already the more dystopic aspects of this coming to play during this coronavirus emergency. I saw in UK there have been 5G towers being burnt down.
Yes.
And there's a kind of conspiracy theory in the US.
Yeah.
But this basically, this idea that 5G is causing coronavirus.
Yes.
And
which is linked to a certain anti-Chinese racism that is quite virulent also at the moment, I'm sure.
Yeah, because and it's linked to Trump's trade war and the targeting of Chinese tech companies. And so in particular, in this case, Huawei, mm-hmm. who have the most sophisticated 5G technology in the world at the moment. And it's been this kind of, I wouldn't say it was Faustian maybe, but as a kind of, it's been a choice that nations have had to make. Mm-hmm. The US has basically said, don't let Huawei into your countries and set up your 5G infrastructure, because there will be a back end for the Chinese state to covertly surveil your citizens. And then I think actually countries like Germany have not towed that kind of Trumpian American line, and the UK as well, because they want faster 5G satellite internet, basically. Yeah. But now all these kind of forces, now that there's a kind of racist kind of yellow peril, kind of fear of China, that these kind of, obviously the fears which are planted within Trump's rhetoric come to the fore in these kind of uncertain times. And yeah, people are doing crazy things like burning down 5G towers. And so, I mean, these are things that I couldn't have anticipated 6 months ago when we did the exhibition, but the kind of scenarios we're interested in exploring.
Yes, but it's true that we have to consider digital communication from an urgent perspective, or maybe the mainstream use of digital communication, which has replaced all over the world, has replaced a lot of the analog or personal or direct communication we have had before. Requires, I think, for a lot of people who maybe haven't had this critical view on technology and on cyber self-defense, or I don't know, a data protection, digital resistance. I don't know. Maybe we really have to develop new learning structures, education structures also for every citizen to be in control or in a self-determined use of these technologies.
Yeah, definitely. I think education would be really important, and to like engage with these technologies critically. One thing I was quite interested in on this topic is this idea of techno-orientalism, which is this idea that I think it first really started to emerge in the 1980s. Mm-hmm. So this was at a time when Japan was the kind of rising East Asian economic technological power, and Western countries were incredibly fearful of this kind of technological threat coming from the East. And films like Blade Runner and the genre of like cyberpunk mm-hmm. were in a way like ways to aestheticize but also kind of express Western fears of this technologically advanced dystopian East Asia and the threat and possibilities and desires that represent. But at the end of the day, all it did was reflect, these were like distorted mirror reflections of the West's own kind of insecurities and kind of self image of itself. So the idea of a technologically advanced Japan suddenly challenged the technological superiority of the US, which had been like a kind of presumption for such a long time. And I think the same thing has happened. These narratives like persist for sure in the media. If you read any kind of mainstream Western media site, you'd see the same language and the same images, you know, and it's recycled directly. Sometimes you to see the Blade Runner kind of imagery put up again and again to talk about Chinese AI or something like that. Mm-hmm. And I guess my question would be, how much are these kind of techno-orientalisms, this is kind of updating of Edward Said, how much are they at play at the moment in our approach and relationship to technology in China? So like there are a lot of elements, like people focus on surveillance in China, and it's obviously a surveillance state, but as we all know, mm-hmm. every Western power and every state, essentially modern government, is a surveillance state. Mm-hmm. It's just the way it's presented to the public. And So there are things like a social credit system in China. So it's this idea of essentially using big data, because when you have a surveillance state, you have this mass of data, and China is the biggest population in the world and the biggest surveillance state, and thus they have the largest amount of data, and data being the new oil in the AI economy. They would use that data to create a new form of governance, which is that like, on like a kind of basic level, they create a social credit system where they can monitor through the smart city, through like, so they can monitor whether you as a citizen take out your garbage on Tuesdays as mm-hmm. a citizen, and the smart garbage bin will send that data back to the central database. And then if you don't, they'll find like a way to like punish you within your social credit store. So maybe you won't be able to buy a plane ticket or something like that. You won't be able to cross a border. So it's this kind of extrapolating the Internet of Things across an entire urban framework and into a new model of governance. And obviously this is quite, you could say, extreme in a way, but then, I mean, how different is it if we could even get into the nitty gritty of it? How different is it from the credit score? It's like one is within this kind of communist kind of party state system, one is in with this capitalist system, but people are basically cut out of certain services based mm-hmm. on their credit score, mm-hmm. based on their spending. So again, it's this idea of like how much are these things really an ontological threat to the West, and how much are they actually just reflections of our own fears about our own societies? And I think that's a really important thing to look at clearly in this topic. And I guess that the next kind of level of this is in relation to the COVID crisis. And I needn't repeat mm-hmm. things that people are probably reading in the newspapers every day, but I remember quite clearly in early February when China was and Hong Kong were the governments were enforcing these lockdowns, and that Western countries were saying, well, that's all well and good, but that's impossible in a liberal democracy. That's only possible in an East Asian authoritarian country. And then lo and behold, 1 month later, almost every government is enforcing these lockdowns, and a lot of times in a more strict way than East Asian countries. And so, yeah, setting up this division between what's possible and possible, it's no longer, it doesn't seem like the right prism to view things at the moment, I think. Yeah, I think it would give us more clarity of vision if we kind of look through a less techno-orientalist lens and kind of see how we're all kind of independent, and a lot of the world is dependent on China because of globalization, the way it's been structured the last 30 years, fortunately or unfortunately.
To close this conversation, I would really like to ask about your perspective on art production under the current conditions. Because you're an artist who has been working with digital technologies and media a lot. You have been working with mainly video installation in your work, Kishi the Vampire. In Queen Zomia, you were working with a hologram. And in your next production, you will use an artificial intelligence presence on stage. I would be interested in briefly hearing from you about your what kind of potential do you see in this entanglement between digital media, digital art, and live arts? And can you imagine, you know, translating one into the other, or producing art that is still live art but in a digital space?
Yeah, it's a really interesting question, I guess. Within the performing arts and in the arts field in general, it's going to be something we're all going to have to deal with, particularly if international travel becomes more and more difficult.
Absolutely.
And especially in the performing arts, I mean, it's so much based on this presence, the presence of the performer. And I'm quite interested in this kind of aura of the presence of the performer, of the human, and whether this can be synthesized or with technology. The piece I showed at Carbonagel 2 years ago, Queen Zomia, essentially that was me standing inside a translucent pyramid in which holograms are projected on the inside. And most of the time you couldn't see me, but using the lighting, sometimes I would kind of fade in. And one of the interesting comments I got from that performance was that I think maybe one of the hooks were that nobody quite knew whether there was a person inside the pyramid. Mm-hmm. And they spent the entire performance trying to guess whether I was really there. Or even when the light shone on my face, they thought, oh, maybe that's a hologram as well. Mm-hmm. And so it was kind of an attempt to play with that ambiguity in a way, like, is the artist present? And maybe is, maybe isn't. But even the absence of the artist is a kind of presence as well, just like playing with that, the notion of presence and absence. So I think definitely digital technologies will allow us to work through some of these issues. So like a lot of the current immersive medias like virtual reality and augmented reality would be a way to work through this as well, where the human presence comes from the audience themselves being a kind of the center of the artwork. Should be quite interesting. And I was also thinking, this is maybe going a bit far, but again, this concept of presence, and I was reading a while ago about, there's a virtual reality lab in Barcelona, and they've been doing experiments with virtual reality. And one of the experiments was to, so essentially they would make a 3D digital scan of you, and then you would put on a virtual reality headset, and the first thing you would see would be yourself. digitally scanned an exact photorealistic replica of you, which was animated in front of you. And they found that if a scientist actually physically touched you, the individual inside the virtual reality, somehow there was a phantom presence in this doppelganger version of yourself in the virtual reality. Mm-hmm. And then they would actually feel the sensation in the body of this virtual version of yourself, which essentially suggests that, that you can have a kind of out-of-body experience through virtual reality. And it's just a kind of possibility of what might be explored in the future of, like, phantom performers and, like, really getting onto a neurological level and tricking audiences into believing that the illusion of presence, essentially. Like, what is this illusory idea of, or kind of mystical idea of, the presence of the artist? It is a function of the human brain. So maybe there's a way to actually get into the human brain and trick it into thinking that there is a presence there when there isn't, through digital technology. So, yeah, who knows where things are going to go in the future.
I still hope that you will be present here as Royce Royce and not as a phantom performer really soon at Kampnagel in Hamburg, when we will present your next work. So let's keep fingers crossed that you can travel physical borders really soon next year. Yeah. For your performance. Really, I want to thank you so much for this talk. I think it has been super interesting speaking to you about these topics. And I'll see you soon.
Thank you so much. Bye.